Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's getting acquainted with the companies, really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
And this was kind of the big social media story in the news. Twitter said that it is based on the behavior of an account. So if an account looks particular...
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, and a good afternoon, everyone. G is now gone. It's just me, and we're talking business. Yes, we the markets open this morning, even though it is a holiday Monday. Of course, we still got to break into the business news here today and chat about some things that are impacting everything in your business world. So John Hansen here right now until 1 o'clock. And joining me now, or actually, let's tease a little ahead. Well, we're going to talk to Elise Glink, who's, by the way, enjoying her holiday out in Hawaii. So we'll be talking to her towards the end of the hour, and also talking to Megan Blandon a little bit about the best bike helmets. It's actually fascinating. Virginia Tech has a helmet lab. I want to talk to Megan about that and the best bicycle helmets, because that could actually end up being not only a great Christmas gift to give to a kid or a teenager or a young adult, but one that might save their lives. But there's good helmets, there's bad helmets, or I should say there's better helmets out there than others. She'll break that down for us. Joining me now on the line, though, right now is David Neamy. He's the Vice President of Measurement and Evaluations at Kaplan. A lot of us know the name of Kaplan, and also the editor of Learning Analytics and Education. David, thanks for spending some of your holiday Monday here with us on WGN.
Oh, thanks, John. Glad to do it.
All right, so we're talking about data in education, how to make an educational experience better for learners by using data. And I can already hear some of our listeners rolling their eyes that went to school, they learned off the chalkboard, they learned what their teachers told us, that there wasn't data in education. Either dispel that rumor or talk about why now learning is better when we do have data driving some of the teaching techniques.
Well, let's kind of start with the basics, which is learning is always better when you have some idea how you're doing, when you get some feedback that's telling you, you know, gee, you missed this, let's work a little, spend a little more time on that, and so on. So you always want to have some kind of assessment and feedback in whatever situation you're in now. But now we're in a situation where we have huge amounts of data available, particularly for students who are studying online. And more students every year are studying online. And there are, you know, huge MOOCs, massive open online courses that have tens of thousands of students in them. And that means we can collect a huge amount of data on what students are doing. And the big question, the question that's sort of driving this new field of learning analytics is, can we do anything with those data to help students actually learn better? And particularly those students who are struggling, because they're, you know, as we all know, there are some students who can just cope with any kind of bad instruction in whatever program they have, and they'll almost teach themselves given, you know, some reasonable resources. But for many students, that's not true. A huge percentage of students never graduate from college. A huge number of students never get to college, and so on. So what this is all about is, can we tell from all the ocean of data we're swimming in now what things will actually help all those students who might be struggling?
So, David, I just to kind of conceptualize this a little bit better, when you say that we have data, is it just like, here's who gets answers right and here's who gets them wrong, breaking down by gender, maybe race, socioeconomic standards, or does it go deeper than that? Do we show where students might miss questions, miss problems, misunderstand things? Does it dive deeper or is it more surface level?
Well, right now, I'd say, and this is kind of a generalization, but we're more on the surface level. And where we need to be is, you know, diving more deeply into that ocean of data, which gets at exactly the kind of questions you were just raising, John. Because it's not enough to just have data that tell us some students are failing or not doing well, or be able to predict that certain categories of students are not likely to succeed. If you don't know what to do about that, and in many cases, that's a big problem in education, too. You know, a ninth grade teacher whose students are not doing well doesn't necessarily know, have all the strategies available to help fix that. So we really needed the data to be doing exactly what you were just suggesting.
Going a little bit deeper. Okay, so then my question is, David, so let's say you get this data. You have this book, Learning Analytics and Education. What is your role then as the Vice President of Measurement and Evaluation, or what are other people doing at Kaplan? Because obviously each school district has its own set of rules and regulations. States each set their curriculum. There's different rules, in whether it's private, charter, public schools. How do you guys get this information so that it translates to that teacher in that room and what they can then do with that data?
Well, the challenge that we're addressing is exactly that one. You know, we've got all this wealth of data available, you can't just, you know, give all that raw data to teachers and students. And students, you know, can do a lot of data themselves, you know, good information about what you might spend a little more time on, what you might look at to help you with particular areas is really helpful to students, not just faculty or teachers. So that's the thing we're working on. You know, how do we deal with the data we have on students? And by the way, another big challenge for us and for everybody is mixed in with all the data. You need some good measures of whether students are actually learning anything. Are they actually measuring? I mean, are they actually mastering the skills that you're trying to teach them or not? And too often, you know, colleges and universities, K through 12 at all levels, we do not have good measures of what students are actually learning. And that's sort of a prerequisite, a foundational thing for building good analytic approaches. So we need to get those data in play too. And then we can look at everything else that might be affecting how well students are learning.
And I guess what you're kind of saying here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea is that sometimes what's taught to us, and I remember doing this as a student too, memorizing the year things happen for history as opposed to talking through or really understanding. Like, I would memorize base level facts, or I would memorize certain things that I could just regurgitate without actually learning the skill set to be able to solve those problems or to go deeper. So how do we get that data? I mean, is that about how we administer tests differently? Is it a lot more involved process where we want to actually like see the students work step by step by step to kind of see where things go wrong? I mean, maybe you can walk through that complicated situation.
Yeah, it is a complicated situation. And, you know, right now, a lot of the tests we have, the kinds of tests we build, are the things that are cheap and easy to build and easy to score, big multiple choice tests. And those aren't always the right things to measure every kind of skill that we're trying to teach. Because in the end, you want students to be able to do something with what they've learned. If they're whatever field they're beginning to learn in, you want to know what people who are good in that field can actually do, and you want to define that as the goals of your instruction and your assessment. You want to say, well, you know, what does an expert financial advisor actually know how to do? Hmm. And what does that person do every day in their work? And how do we teach students to do that? Right now, I would say in most fields, we haven't defined that well enough. We're teaching a lot of the kind of stuff that you just mentioned, because mm-hmm. it's easy to assess that. How many facts have you memorized?
Well, right.
That's easy to assess. But can you actually apply those? Can you put those together to build financial reports for a wide variety of different kinds of organizations and different industries and so on? That's what you want students to know how to do. But for them to do that, that has to be the goal of your teaching, and that has to be what you're assessing.
Interesting. So you're trying to connect the dots at an early point from saying, look, it's not just about the theory, it's just not about the facts, but you want to see, you know, what at the end goal of an education, the idea is you get a good job that sustains you throughout your life. So you're kind of looking at the finish line and almost working backwards from there.
That's exactly right. And taking it, I mean, it's tricky to do when you're thinking about what should students in elementary school be learning.
Yes,
well, you want to give them a broad foundation that they could use potentially in anything they decide to go into. Well, right now, that's not how we're building elementary education. We're just basically making up stuff based on what we taught kids in the past. It's not, well, you know, what are they going to need? And that could be hard to predict because, you know, as you know, a lot of careers people are in now didn't exist when they were in elementary school. So, and that's going to be the same for kids learning now. So this is a big challenge. How do we figure out what is the core knowledge kind of that everybody's going to need in the future?
The book is Learning Analytics in Education. And David, you know, who should be reading a book like this?
Well, this is, it's kind of intended as a sort of academic read for people who are interested in learning analytics and working in the field. It actually came about as a result of a project funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and by the MacArthur Foundation, which got together a bunch of people, researchers and educators, to kind of think through what should learning analytics be about and how should it be organized. So it's about, you know, if anyone who just kind of wants to know what is this new field about, what can it potentially do, and particularly those who are studying, there are now programs in learning analytics in a number of universities around the country. So some people may be using it as a textbook for those courses and so on.
But okay.
It's just kind of an introduction or an overview to.
So it's not a stocking stuffer for my niece and nephews.
Probably not.
All right. It wasn't a last-minute Christmas gift. But no, it's important stuff. It's obviously an emerging field that we're diving into deeper. And David, thank you so much for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
720 WGN and a happy Christmas Eve. Merry Christmas Eve to everyone out there. Hope you're having a wonderful day if you're driving about. We're still talking about business. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, but a really cool story and a ranking for something that I didn't even know existed. It's a Virginia Tech has a helmet lab, and joining us now to chat about that and really what helmets are better than others is Megan Bland. You're a graduate research assistant there. Megan, thanks for joining us here on Christmas Eve.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Okay, so Megan, I got to ask about this. How cool, I didn't know Virginia Tech had a helmet lab. Do you know how the lab got started? Why Virginia Tech? I mean, it must be really cool to work there.
I'm biased, but I think it's pretty cool too. Essentially, the lab got its start in what we call injury biomechanics. So understanding how people are injured in sort of impact scenarios, like in car accidents. But concussion in particular is a really difficult injury to understand. And so the helmet lab started out really looking at how do football players, for instance, sustain concussion. Basically, we put sensors in their helmets and we started to measure the sort of head impact they're experiencing. And then from that, we eventually were able to design tests in a laboratory setting to evaluate a number of different helmet models to understand how effective they are compared to each other in reducing risk of head injury. So we've applied that to bicycle helmets as well.
So I this is going to be an obvious answer, but it goes without saying. So we have a program here in Chicago called Divvy, which is like ride sharing for bikes. And I had never really biked in Chicago, but I thought I'd do it, and I did. And I was like, you know, I'm an adult now. As a kid, I didn't wear a bike helmet. I imagine a lot of adults out there. I know. I didn't, though. You know, we didn't. You see it a lot more nowadays, which thank God. But a lot of us didn't. I was wondering, I mean, it goes without saying, right? Everyone, if you are on the road, I don't care how young you are, how old you are, how experienced you are, if it's rural, if it's urban. I mean, bike helmets, I mean, they save thousands of lives every year, I imagine.
Absolutely, yes. Their helmets are very effective in reducing your risk of head injury. And that's kind of something we, aside from pointing out how safe helmets are relative to each other, we hope to draw attention to the fact that this is a safety product. You need to wear a helmet to really reduce your risk of injury and death, even.
Yeah. All right, so step one was me going to get a helmet, which is great. I was like, I'm being smart. I'm being great. I got a bicycle helmet. Then I went to the store and picked the cheapest one. That's probably a bad way of choosing a helmet, right, just by price.
It's interesting. You know, I've actually evaluated a number of helmets in my time, bicycle helmets specifically, and there's not a great correlation between price and performance.
Really?
There's a slight correlation.
Mine was just a bucket. Mine was just a bucket on my head for $14. No, but yeah, why don't you walk us through how you guys rank these helmets?
Sure, of course. So essentially, our goal is to simulate what a cyclist might experience in a head impact in an accident in a laboratory setting. So I've decided what the most realistic conditions are, and I've turned that into a laboratory test, which I then apply to a bunch of different helmet models. And essentially, I look at that helmet's ability to reduce the head impact forces or reduce the energy of that impact that your head would see. And I use that to understand how your risk of head injury would be reduced. So basically, I'm doing an apples-to-apples comparison of all these different bicycle helmets, and I can say definitively, okay, this one reduces your risk of injury more than another.
How do you get to that line? Do you use like a dummy? You put the helmet on, you have sensors to tell where the impacts are, how hard they were or something. How do you translate what you do in a lab to what happens inside our bodies when we get in an accident?
Right, that's spot on. We do use a dummy that's instrumented with different sensors that we can use to measure the head impact forces and accelerations, really. And through just decades of head injury research, both in our lab and in labs all over the world, we've kind of grown to understand what sort of impacts lead to injury. So we know what sort of accelerations and velocities are indicative of what's going on inside your skull, basically. So we understand how the brain moves around inside your skull, how that relates to risk of injury. So we're using these tests to then translate our impact results to our sort of understanding of head injury through what we call a risk function.
So I'm looking at the website now where you have the rankings, and what I really like is that you can sort by all, so you can see all these helmets and you have star ratings, but also road style, urban style, mountain style, snow certified, things that are under $100. So if you really are, you know, a lot of listeners may not have the opportunity to buy a $200 or $300 helmet, you know, what the best one you're going to get for under $100 is. Is it because each one of those styles, it leaves you susceptible to different types of injuries?
I would say the helmets are all kind of designed to reduce the same injuries, essentially. So they're designed with the same goal in mind, but that doesn't necessarily pan out that way. So, for instance, we've seen trends that road-style helmets, which are more of your traditional helmet with an elongated shape and a lot of vents, actually tend to be more protective than what we call an urban-style helmet, which is kind of a stiffer helmet that has a thicker shell and it's more rounded and has less vents. And really, they're trying to protect against the same impact scenario, so they should be protecting the same injuries. Some are just a little bit less effective than others.
Oh, interesting. So it doesn't matter. I mean, you're bound to maybe experience the same sort of injuries no matter what sort of biking style you're doing. But it all comes down to the style you like and those sorts of things, and you rank them by that. So I guess what I wanted to ask is, if you drum roll, what was the best helmet out there that you think that? And obviously, there's risk no matter what you're doing with helmets. Of course, helmet or no helmet, of course, there's never a guarantee. But what is the best one for reducing injury or potentially a fatality?
Well, so right now we have on our website, like you talked about, all of these different helmets rated from 5 stars to 1 star. The current leading helmet, which again you can find on the website, is called the Bontrager Ballista MIPS. And I want to draw attention specifically to the fact that last word, MIPS, that stands for Multi-Directional Impact Protection System. Mm-hmm. And that actually serves to reduce, it's essentially a technology that's inside the helmet, and it's inside a whole bunch of different types of helmets that serves to reduce the rotational forces that your head sees, because we know that rotational forces are actually very indicative of brain injury risk. They kind of reflect what's going on inside the skull the best. So there are technologies in bike helmets and other types of helmets that are aimed specifically at reducing risk of head injury. And those have been pretty effective.
And that's the Bontrager Quantum MIPS. How much does that one cost?
That's the Bontrager Ballista MIPS, actually.
Oh, okay.
That one is $200.
Okay. And if you were saying under $100 or something that you think that someone could give, maybe, I mean, it makes a good Christmas gift, I'm not going to lie. What a last minute gift, what would be a good one for someone that's looking for something maybe a little more affordable?
So if you do sort by gifts or helmets that are under $100, the top 5-star helmet there is called the Specialized Chamonix MIPS. But there are a number of 5- and 4-star helmets that all are $100 that I would definitely recommend.
And Megan, I imagine you think that's a great Christmas gift.
I did buy my dad one for Christmas. I think so.
Megan, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you.
WGN, John Hansen here for the Wintrust Business Lunch and for Steve Bertrand. No Wintrust Business Lunch tomorrow, but I'll be back Wednesday and through the rest of the week with your business lunches all the way on through until the new year. All right, so when we think about an occupation, we often have to rely on things we've seen on TV or heard on the radio to try and glean about what that job is like, if we're not in this field, I should say. And we start to, we use sitcoms or TV shows to try and form that basis for what we think that job is all about. At least that's what I thought is the one way we try and figure out what that job's all about if we don't have that job. But it actually might be changing to Google image searches or other search engine searches of images that actually start to form our opinions of what jobs are and what they're like and who works in those sorts of jobs. So here to break all that down is Adam Hughes. He's the computational social scientist at Pew Research. Adam, thanks for joining us here on Christmas Eve.
Thanks very much for having me.
I hope I've set that up right, because I just was reading this article and it is really fascinating. Number one, that image searches are so important to us for how we form our basis, not only for what we think about jobs or occupations, but all sorts of things, that really the new media, the simple search for images, can really impact our prejudices on what we think about the workforce, right?
Well, I think we're really excited about online image searches as sort of a new window into the way that individuals form sort of ideas about jobs or about other things. And so the research team that I work on was interested in saying, can we use this new tool as a data source and try and understand a little bit more about where people are sort of seeing images or the images that search engines return to them?
So what I want to know is, first of all, like for Google Images searches, when you type something in and you search it, you're going to see tons and tons of photos. You can scroll and see more. They're all presented to you right in front of you. I mean, Google's obviously pulling those images from the internet. Who are the biggest contributor to the photos that are on the internet? Because it's not like Google puts these photos up themselves. They're pulling from other sources. Where are those other sources that end up forming this mosaic of what a job looks like?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and in fact, it's one that the research team didn't really have a clear answer to. And we do know a little bit about the way Google image search works. It tries to find things that are relevant to the person who's conducting the search. So a lot of the images that it will return are based on different websites, and those websites have text on them as well, and then Google is trying to provide the user with whatever is relevant. And we also know that the search algorithm is capable of learning from both content consumers and content producers. So if content producers often use men to illustrate a term like chief executive, then the algorithms might preserve or magnify that tendency.
Interesting. So obviously media organizations are putting up a lot of photos of those sorts of things, businesses themselves. Is it also pulling from like stock images that are made by companies that produce these sorts of images?
Well, I can't say when we were doing the research, we definitely saw some stock images in the results.
Okay. All right. So the fascinating breakdown is when you look at certain jobs. So I guess on the whole, are women more represented or less represented in the workforce when you talk about jobs on the whole?
Well, jobs on the whole, they're less represented. So if you look at the 105 popular jobs, which is the ones that we conducted searches for, in that set of jobs, 54% of the individuals working them are men.
Okay.
And what we found is that in image searches for those same jobs, 60% of the individuals that appeared in the results were men and 40% were women.
Okay.
So that's about a 6 percentage point difference there.
I imagine what's fascinating is not only the overall number, but there've got to be jobs out there where you see like this stark difference from reality.
Yes, that's definitely the case. So to give you an example, we did some searches for jobs like bill collector or interviewer. And bill collector, we know from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics that 72% of folks who work as bill collectors are women.
Hmm.
It's 71%. But in the image searches that we conducted, we saw women only 20% of the time. So the other 80% of individuals in those image results were men.
So that's a 51% difference from what the actual reality is versus what Google image searches shows us.
Yes, that's right. But I should note that for a good number of searches, those numbers are a lot smaller. I kind of picked one that was on the tail end. But for 16% of all the searches, the image results were within 5 percentage points of the actual share of men and women in each job.
Other jobs that women are underrepresented in, what are some other ones that kind of have that stark difference?
Well, there were about 10 jobs where we really saw that the underrepresentation was concentrated in, and on average it was about a 33 percentage point difference, meaning that women appeared in the image searches 33% on average less likely than they would if the images perfectly represented reality. And those other jobs include things like interviewer, which I mentioned, medical records technician, claims adjuster, news analyst, restaurant host, office clerk, and bartender.
Okay. What about, are there any searches that show that women are overrepresented, meaning that in the image searches you see a lot more women or some more women than are actually in that profession?
Absolutely. So we did see the other case happening a bit, but not quite as pronounced. So some examples there include singer, mechanic, aircraft pilot, maintenance worker, or computer support specialist.
It's interesting. I guess what is someone who's listening to this says, okay, well, what's the big deal? So Google image searches pulls from some of these things. I imagine some of these underrepresentations or overrepresentations are also baked into the culture that we have. We have a misguided sense of things by some of the things I listed before, TV shows, stuff like that. So what's the problem if Google images are pulling in all this? I don't know if that's something that you guys even postulate on, but what is the issue with that? Are you guys just looking at the raw data and just simply giving us the facts?
Yeah, I think in this case, we didn't really want to sort of make any claims. of that nature. Really, we were just interested in extending a long-standing line of research that the Pew Research Center has focused on that looks at how men and women experience their work. And in the past, we've done a lot of survey research that sort of sees what women's experiences are like in a male-dominated environment, for example, or what types of attributes people look for in male or female leaders. And we thought that this would be a new window into kind of the way that the world thinks about gender in the workplace. But we didn't really come into it thinking anything about sort of whether it's a good or bad
thing. How many images did you look at for each job? Like, what was the total of the mosaic you were looking at?
So we got 100 images for each job, and, you know, times 105 jobs, you're looking at over 10,000 images. And in fact, we also did an additional sort of exploratory analysis of a bunch of different searches in other languages with the settings to sort of set to approximate other countries.
Did you see differences?
Yes, there were some notable differences, but one of the sort of striking findings about that analysis that explored the global results is that for many occupations across different country language combinations, the rate at which women appear was rather similar. So to give you one example, for CEO across 18 different country language combinations, women were never shown more than 25% of the time.
Oh, that's fascinating. Also interesting in this, and I want to know, so if you have 100 images you're looking at, obviously Google kind of ranks them based on what they think you should be looking for, or, you know, I don't know the exact analytics they use or what's hit on the most. So when you look at that 100, do women equally appear scattered throughout 1 to 100, or is there a bias also in terms of how many, whether women or men are represented over or under in terms of 1 through 100? Do you understand the question I'm trying to ask?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And we looked at that. We were very interested in sort of the position of men and women in the results. And so for the U.S. analysis, we basically just cataloged, did this first women in the result appear in the first place, the second place, so on down the list of different options. And what we found was, on average, the first man appeared in the second image, and the first woman appeared in the fourth image.
Oh, wow.
Across these 105 jobs. So a little bit of a difference there, too.
I could dive into this research forever. I do have one other question. The idea of gender diversity in a blanket statement, is it more diverse on Google images, or is it more diverse in real life?
Well, this was one finding that I hoped we'd get to discuss a little bit, because it's kind of nuanced. What we found is that, you know, if you look at the BLS data on the actual number of men and women who work in these 105 jobs, in 38% of the jobs, we're looking at workplace or workforces that are 80% just men or just women.
Oh, really?
Or more than that.
Wow.
So that's the real world. And what we found in image searches is that across these same 105 jobs, just 21% showed men or women 80% plus of the time.
So while we skew different ways, and we are a little off reality on certainly some job searches, on the broad whole, we have more diversity in the workforce, in theory, for those 105 jobs or online than we do in the workforce, on a broad statement.
In the way that they're represented in the image search results.
All right. You got to go to pewsocialtrends.org to read more about this. We really appreciate your time today, and enjoy your holiday, Adam, okay?
All right. Happy holidays to you, too.
Oh, that is fascinating stuff. I love good research like that. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break. We'll be back with more here on the Winter's Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. The Hancock Center will need to wait a bit longer for a new owner, as the $300 million deal has fallen apart based on mutual agreements from both parties. The details have not been announced as to why the deal fell apart, but it's a blemish on Sterling Bay's resume after seemingly buying its way through anything it's interested in. They also bought Prudential Plaza early in the year for $1.2 billion and Groupon's headquarters at 600 West Chicago Avenue. And if you remember, they were also pretty big players in the H2Q Amazon dealings when talks were around town. But who knows? That just means more opportunity for different and maybe smaller buyers. And speaking of the small guy, our hats go off to Michigan-based Floracraft, who is dishing out nearly $4 million of bonuses for their 200 employees. Based on employee tenure, the average holiday bonus for them will be $20,000. That would make your year. and some employees will even get something in the ballpark of $60,000. Congrats. We raise one up to you, the craft and product manufacturer, Floracraft. I'm Bennett Wake Knight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time in the city. 720 WGN, just wrapping up here, the Wintrust Business Lunch. Yeah, the markets, another down day might want to make you bury your head in the sand. But if you go to North Avenue Beach, it's going to be really hard to get your head on in that sand to ignore it. It's cold, it's hard, all the beaches here in Chicago can't do that. But one person that might be able to bury your head in the sand, if she so chooses, is Elise Glink. And Elise, you're joining us from Hawaii, right?
I am. I finally managed a couple of days off, and a very Merry Christmas to you, John, and to our all of our friends at WGN Radio and our listeners.
It's great to have you on, of course, from thinklink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. Elise, obviously these markets are what people talk about. I mean, I think everyone was just kind of hoping for an up day on this last day of trading before the break tomorrow. Obviously, it didn't happen. I know we would just want to be thinking about Christmas instead. What are your thoughts on the falling markets?
Well, I think we might have had an update, except that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin seemed that he wanted to tell the world that everything is okay. And by doing so, I think he really rattled things.
Yeah.
In fact, I woke up this morning to that news and I thought, what is he doing exactly? Because it's hard to understand what the strategy is.
Yeah, you imagine it's one of those things that the more you try to, it's like the more you try and say everything's okay, the less confident people are in that assessment.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the stress test that we did 10 years ago, and really you have to be mindful of all the other messages that are going out. We've just been celebrating is really the wrong word, but the 10th anniversary of the Great Recession, and, you know, people, lots of news stories about people really still feeling the effects of it in many ways. We've got, you know, the best economy, and yet we've got, you know, the president who's bemoaning, you know, Jerome Powell as his pick of Fed chief. So there's already a lot of instability in messaging coming out. And now you see this, and it reminds me of the stress test from 10 years ago when they were like, no, we stress tested the banks and they're all just fine. And there was so much concern that that wasn't really the truth.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like you say, like every reading we have, or most readings we have, are good news. It's something that's obviously rattled the market going forward. Do you think that maybe a solid holiday shopping season, if we see that, if we get some good news, some good earnings reports here this quarter four, do you think that could really change things around in the new year, or is the market officially spooked?
I think we're beyond shopping helping us here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great that people are out shopping in the malls that we're visiting, you know, around here. I mean, they're mobbed, like mobbed, but in a good way, with people with
right.
their credit cards waving around.
Yes.
But you know, I think that there's a larger issue to be focusing on, and that's what's going on globally. And if you look globally, and even if you look at the U.S. stock market beyond the Dow, right, you look at what's going on with sort of the larger majority of the Fortune 500, and if you look globally what's going on, you're seeing that economies, if they're not already contracting, are starting to really slow down in growth. China has said that they've slowed, and while those numbers may or may not be able to be trusted to be exact, it's a trend line, right? So, you know, you've got China that seems to be, you know, contracting a bit. You've got growth in Europe, you know, a little bit unstable. You've got Latin America that's running into some problems. So when you look at, you know, what's going on in the major economies of the world, this is a time where after 10 years of growth, mediocre though it may have been in some years, 10 years of growth, and now it seems like the world is pulling back a bit, and that is going to affect the U.S.
Yeah, Lisa, I got to ask you, and I know we wanted to talk about freelancers and all this other stuff, but I everyone's minds are on the markets right now. I also wonder, this is a strange way to put it, but, you know, we have easing abilities that the Fed has been able to do. They're not going to do this, but if they were to lower the rates, they have abilities to do that. I almost feel like the White House has now these baked-in easing opportunities to ease off talk of tariffs, to ease off on these sorts of things. Could news from the White House in January or February, positive news, could that be something that could resettle the ship a little bit?
I think what needs to settle the ship is a period of, wait for it, stability.
Oh,
I think
wow.
we need stability of messages. I think we need stability of good news in you know, global economies. I think that we need to have the political stuff settle down quite a bit, and everybody just kind of come back from the holidays, get back to business, and enjoy what's left of these really good economies while we have them. And everything is cyclical. We're going to see a downturn, but it doesn't have to be the first week of January. In fact, most of the economists that I talk to are thinking that we're not going to see a downturn in the U.S. until 2020. Other things can push that forward, meaning into 2019, but let's hope now. Let's hope that we settle things down and everybody just kind of buckles down and gets back to business.
Elise, I made a nice short segment for you today because you could just get back and enjoy Hawaii, the vacation.
Well, it is nice to have a few days off with my family, John, and I hope that you and your whole family has a nice holiday as well. Yeah.